host, and you need to take into account the speaker, you need to take into account the context, your relationship with them, the way that you feel at that point, you know, whether you're really paying attention or just a little bit. And despite all that, and I think this is really what I do think is interesting, is despite all that noise and that extra kind of effort going on, if you present people with thin slices and you just have enough speakers, they're still really good at detecting, you know, making these predictions, right? I mean, that's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah.
If I throw 50 voices at you, you're pretty accurate at telling me who's a doctor, who's a, I mean, really, those things do happen, right? It's like professions, it's like...
Hey, everybody. Thanks for checking out our podcast, Understanding Our Place in the World. The podcast is brought to you by the Department of Psychology at the University of Essex. My name is Philip Cosolino, and I am an experimental social psychologist at Essex, and my guest today is Professor Silke Pullman, a colleague of mine at Essex. Silke explores the way we communicate emotions and attitudes via speech. She's also involved in research that attempts to answer how vocal emotions are communicated cross-culturally. Some of her recent work also explores how social psychological variables such as power and motivation can influence the emotions and the attitudes we communicate through our tone of voice. Silke and I spoke recently about her past and current work and just how important it is for us to understand that it's not what you say, it's how you say it. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Hi, Silke Pullman. Thanks for coming on the podcast. It's nice to have you on.
Oh, hi, Philip. Thank you for having me.
I've been looking forward to this conversation. I've worked with you on some research. We've collaborated together, so I know a little bit about what you're doing more recently. But why don't we step back, as we always do on the podcast, and take us back to the beginning, where you started before you got to Essex and doing the research you're doing now.
So where do you want me to start? At the very
wherever you're comfortable.
At the very beginning. I studied linguistics, American literature and media in both Germany and the Netherlands. And then as part of my linguistics degree, I got interested in psycholinguistics, and in particular into how bilinguals process language. And so the first kind of research experience that I had was during my master's thesis, which I did at a research institute in Germany. And we looked at the effects of ambiguities. So, and how far does it matter if an English word has two meanings in German, for instance? Like a classical example is the word Chef, which means boss in German, and cook in English, right? I always have to kind of think, I think that's the way around. And, you know, what happens in a bilingual brain when they process those types of ambiguities, or the German word form Schloss can translate into English lock and castle. And so we played around with those types of words and just looked at what happens in the brain for English German bilinguals. And that's how my research career started, I think.
How many languages do you actually speak?
Well, I always say I speak German, but, you know, I'm also mm-hmm. reasonably fluent in English, and I can communicate in French and Dutch if I have to. I had to learn Spanish at university, and there was a short time in my high school years when I also had to learn Latin, but don't ask me anything about about that.
Oh, my goodness. I speak one language, which I have yet to master, but I'm still working at it.
You're great. Great with words, as we know. Whenever I have an issue, I'll come and ask you. I'm like, Philip, help me.
So what about PhD research? Let's get into that a little bit.
Yeah, so while I did my this research on bilingualism, I happened to get to know several people who worked at that research institute, and they said, we don't have any work related to bilingualism, but if you really want to get into patient work, then, you know, we have something for you. And it's something that's very new, because we're interested in explore in how far people with brain lesions process emotions from speech. And it was very new at the time, I think, because predominantly people had focused on facial expressions and how we communicate emotions through facial expressions. And so I embarked on a 3-year journey at the Max Planck Institute for Human Cognitive and Brain Sciences in Leipzig to study exactly that. How do people with brain lesions process emotions from speech?
And what did you find? If it could be distilled, I mean, obviously, I realize as soon as you ask a question like that, it's like, what are you asking someone? I mean, they've been 3 years, right? It's not, it's just, oh, I found nothing. Right.
No, I found lots. And I think that was in hindsight, I think that was the problem. But the take home message was that, as expected, the people with brain damage were the ones who processed emotions less well, who had difficulties understanding how other people express how they feel. And we looked a bit more into which brain regions are implicated in this emotional vocal network, and in how far does a lesion, let's say, to your orbital frontal cortex result in different responses than having a lesion to your basal, to the basal ganglia.
A couple of questions are popping into my head. Was there any sort of distinguishing among the emotions, you know, negative, positive, surprise, whatever there might be, or was it just emotional content in general?
So for the basal ganglia patients, for instance, we found that in particular emotions, negative emotions were implicated, and particular disgust. That wasn't something that people didn't know. It was always kind of argued that disgust is an emotion that recruits the basal ganglia. What we could find is that it really depended on how you transmitted that information, for instance, you know, what kind of vocal cues people used when they communicated how they felt disgust and how that affects people. We also found for orbital frontal cortex region patients that they struggled recognizing all of the 7 emotions that we tested at the time. And in particular, they weren't good at labeling the information. So, you know, while their brain responses were quite similar at early stages, very early after processing, you can look in the brain and check whether people process pitch, intensity, or speech rate, for instance, in the same way that those without brain lesions would, and they did. But at a later point in time, when they have to put a label and make a decision about, you know, what exact emotion was it that the speaker tried to convey, that's where they struggle.
At some level, is this just a sort of a basic research approach to kind of localize and make sense of where, what circuits, what, you know, networks for particular types of emotions, or is there, or was there intervention that could come from this, some sort of applied approach to say, well, let's help them manage emotions more in their social connections?
Yeah, so for me, I think it all started with this basic research, as you suggest, right? Trying to understand which brain regions are recruited during emotional language processing. But when you work with these populations, you talk to the patients, you talk to their family members, and I think it becomes clear very, very rapidly that it's not just a population that you study in order to get insight into how the brain functions, but that ideally your work should also help them to overcome their communication issues. And that was something that I think I realized very early on after talking to a lot of family members, where they just said, you know what, I just hope that the research that they're participating in is really going to help speech and language therapists, for instance, to focus on tone of voice processing. They focus on trying to help them recover language functions, such as being able to articulate what they want and what they need. And that's clearly very important. But because of cost issues, obviously, they don't always have the time to also focus on more subtle nuances, like, you know, trying to see whether or not people still process the prosody, that is the way that we speak, in a similar way. And while my research itself wasn't directly aimed at you know, helping speech and language therapists, I think what they can take away from my thesis work is really that it's a worthwhile investment in trying to help people who suffered from stroke and trying to really, you know, help them focus on paying attention to vocal attributes, specific vocal cues, and all of that takes a lot of time. and energy, obviously.
I did not know before I got married that every single day of my life, after I got married, I would be discussing the tone in my voice. Okay? I didn't know that. I was not aware that I spoke in so many different tones. I have since learned, not only do I speak in many different tones, I am often speaking in the incorrect tone. It's your tone, my tone, yes, your tone. What is wrong with my tone? I don't like your tone.
For most of us, it's just it's something we take so for granted, just communicating, speaking, listening. And yet it's just the process is so dynamic. It's so complex. I mean, how many, generally speaking, maybe there are obviously, but what's the range? You're saying, you know, these parameters that we could explore that might vary in all kinds of interesting ways that could be diagnostic for us. I mean, what are we talking about? How many do you guys explore?
So I think by now we explore up to 40, 45 different acoustic parameters. And I think that's the one thing that really fascinates me, is because the brain doesn't need a lot of tools in order to grasp it, right? And we can extract all of these acoustic parameters, and we combine them to form, I don't know, what we call an emotional gestalt, for instance, right? Kind of like, okay, I'm taking these things and I know exactly that this signals danger or this signals happiness, and it just helps us process this information. And remember that speech isn't static. It isn't like a facial expression where you can have a photo and you stop at any given point in time and you can see, oh, the mouth points upwards, probably, you know, still in a good mood or something like that. But speech develops over time, and so do the acoustic attributes. And that's the one thing that we need to consistently and continuously monitor.
It's just so mind-boggling to try to study something that is so flexible and so dynamic. I mean, the thought of like a threatening voice, to me, you know, you could imagine a threatening voice that has volume and real sort of in your face, but you can also imagine a threatening voice that's incredibly quiet and incredibly, you know, calm almost. And yet it's telling you you're being threatened right now. And it's just, well, how can two opposite kind of approaches to communicate be the exact same intent or have the exact same intent? That's intense to try to study that.
Indeed. And I think that's what makes it so difficult at times, right? I mean, we don't just have that for threat. You can think about sadness. I mean, some people are close to being hysteric, I guess, when they're sad and they're just like out of their mind when they're crying and trying to still tell you, but, you know, something. Like, I sometimes observe that with my own children where I realize that they're grasping for air and they're trying to tell you, but, you know, it was so unfair, and they're so high pitched. And yet you can also have people who are like really, really quiet, right? And they're sad in a very different vocal way. And so the brain, you know, still needs to pick up on both instances. Oh, that's someone that I should approach, and I should probably try to comfort them. And we believe that in a lot of those instances, it's the voice quality. So while specific kind of acoustic parameters might go into different directions, there might be an underlying voice quality that's signaled in one of those, you know, 30 plus, 40 plus acoustic parameters that is telling us as a listener what's really going on. And that's what we need to pay attention. But it's a challenge, but it's an exciting one as well. This internal monitoring system that continuously looks for specific acoustic cues and tries to put them together to form this gestalt is really important, because I need to be able to tune towards you, right? Like, that's what I'm adapting to. I only have your voice. I, you know, it doesn't matter whether someone else uses their voice in a very specific, over the top kind of way. If I want to infer how you feel, I need to be able to tune my analysis towards the cues that you're giving me.
It seems like the first step is that monitoring system just has to kind of, like, what's this person, like, how do I even know how to calibrate to you? Because you may be very different than me in communicating that.
And you can see this because I've tried that a little bit by just playing different voices from different people and looking at their brain responses, like at listeners' brain responses. And you can see that their amplitudes really differ in height. And usually people say if the amplitude is larger, then that means that they will have paid more attention or that there was more in-depth processing and those kind of things. But I actually think in this instance, it just shows like this is the baseline for that specific speaker, right? And then they show similar effects, but somehow I need to.
Right. Yeah, because their amplitude is so significantly, let's say, higher than someone else's, doesn't mean that immediately I'm going to assume they're that much more angry than the next person. I have to immediately meet them at that point and go, okay, they're angry.
Yes.
But that other person I met was angry, even though they expressed it differently.
Exactly.
Or in a lower level.
You know, the brain, I think basically, you know, those acoustic cues that people are using are giving me that baseline, right? And that's what's giving me that amplitude. But it doesn't mean that I think that that person is more expressive. No, it's just that.
That's in that thin slice. Just don't, you know, I mean, in a social context, you know, if you know me to be a relatively, let's just use this phrase, low amplitude anger person, and then one day I'm not that, I'm very high amplitude, your experience with me will tell you, oh, something's really gone wrong with Philip today, right? So it's like you're not searching, you know what my baseline is already, yes. You know, so you're not going to try to stay down there. You're going to take that ride, I'd imagine.
Yes, exactly. And that's what I'm saying. Like, we take into account so many different factors, right? That it just becomes really, really complicated. And I think that's why I got upset with my field at some point, because they would just love to say, oh, all positive emotions are going to elicit, you know, a smaller amplitude than all negative emotions, or vice versa, whatever, you know, depending on your viewpoint, left or right, you know, this is what you're going for. And they weren't open to this idea of, no, it's far more subtle at times, and it's more nuanced, and you need to take into account the speaker, you need to take into account the context, your relationship with them, the way that you feel at that point, you know, whether you're really paying attention or just a little bit. And despite all that, and I think this is really what I do think is interesting, is despite all that noise and that extra kind of effort going on, if you present people with thin slices and you just have enough speakers, they're still really good at detecting, you know, making these predictions, right? And that's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah,
like, despite
it
all of us using it in a slightly different way and tuning differently and those kind of things, if I throw 50 voices at you, you're pretty accurate at telling me who's a doctor, really, those things do happen, right? It's like professions. It's like...
So you moved over time from specifically targeting on the emotional context and the emotional tone of voice to, I guess the easy way to put it is a bit more of what, well, you have a course that you teach at Essex called The Social Voice. So what does that mean to you as a shift potentially? I mean, you know, we talked a little bit earlier, and it's kind of sometimes it's not that simple, right? You can't remove emotionality from all things social, right? There's going to be overlap at times, but to the extent that you shifted a little bit away from it, a focus on emotionality, what does that mean for you?
Yeah, I think that it's a really difficult question for me. As I said, for years and years, I really just focused on how do we communicate emotions through speech? How do other people recognize that I feel an emotion? And at some point I thought, but there's so much more that we convey through our voice other than just pure emotionality. Some kind of factors we convey unintentionally, like you will know that I'm female, even without having seen me. So the reason that, you know, I speak in a higher pitch than a male colleague, and that alone is going to give it away. We communicate age. We communicate social status at some point. We communicate a range of different factors just through our voice alone. And I think I just thought I wanted to move away from just studying the emotions that someone's trying to express into subtle nuances. And it just happened that I worked together with a colleague of ours, Netta Weinstein, and she was interested in motivation and said to me at some point, do you think that we can motivate people just through voice cues? And how can we study this? And we were lucky enough to get a Leverhulme Trust grant, and were able to explore that a little bit. And I think that's what shifted my personal kind of focus from emotions to something that we called motivational voice. And that also then led into other endeavors, like the two of us. We looked at how do people perceive whether someone's authentic or not, right? I mean, there are so many, as I said, so many subtle nuances that we can convey through voice that I started to explore a whole range of factors.
Just shift back a little bit to the Netto work, which is, my understanding is this was a motivational work specifically in the context of a sort of a controlling voice, you know, in other words, wanting you to, you know, a voice that conveys, I want you to do a certain thing that you may not want to do, versus more of a voice that fosters autonomy in individuals. Am I correct in that?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So we focused in voice patterns that would elicit control or pressure in listeners. And those that would create a feeling of autonomy support. And we also had what we call the neutral voice in the middle. And we ran a number of studies. And I think probably the more interesting ones for me, again, are the ones that show different brain responses very, very early on, within 200 milliseconds. Listeners distinguish between a voice that is trying to pressure them to do something as opposed to a neutral or autonomy supportive sounding voice, and only I think around 400-500 milliseconds into a sentence do they pick up on the cues that that signal the supportive voice. And I think that was quite striking for me, because it really nicely mirrors the emotional voices, where all of the emotions are usually detected within 200 milliseconds. But here, when you shift it into a more social context, I guess it becomes clear that you're particularly paying attention to people who are trying to get you to do something, right?
The notion there from an SDT, self-determination theory perspective, is that because we're seeking autonomy, we're vigilant for anything which would thwart it, and prevent us from being autonomous.
What was interesting for us is that task independent, right? Irrespective of whether I ask someone to pay attention to the speaker or whether I tell them to pay attention in general, you know, or I think in one experiment, we asked them to monitor whether certain words occur, those kind of things. So we really played around with the focus of attention. Irrespective of that, the controlling sounding voices always elicit this very, very rapid response in the brain. And that just seems to suggest exactly what you said, right? That people are hypervigilant to kind of seeing right. Whether or not someone's trying to take that autonomy away from them. So to say.
Well, that's from a self-determination theory perspective. And Netta and those who love SDT, which I actually do kind of enjoy the theory, but they may not like me saying that it may also just be that, you know, there is another hypothesis, which is that human beings, although autonomy is possible, it may be that our default mode is following, and you know, we're not all leaders, and we are in many ways routinized, and we are easily controlled. I mean, that is just a sad state of affairs that is decades of research supports that. And it just may be that evolutionarily speaking, it made sense to know someone speaking like they're in charge and that they're telling me to do something, maybe I ought to listen to them.
Indeed. And I think, I mean, our results would actually support that kind of interpretation, because we could find these control or pressure effects even in babies, right? So we did eye tracking studies with babies, and again, they pay longer attention if they listen to pressuring sounding voices as opposed to autonomy supportive sounding voices. We could find similar kind of effects in adolescents. And we're currently actually looking at the effects of pressuring and controlling sounding voices in the classroom. And we're working together with a company that happens to have a model that's not linked to self-determination theory, but is linked to you know, what are typical classroom voices that that teachers could express. And let's face it, in the classroom, you very often will have to say something like, you have to sit down now, right? As opposed to, can you please take your seat? It would be nice if you could. Those kind of thing. I mean, sometimes you just want to have an immediate result. And even though everyone seems to agree and know that being controlled doesn't feel good, and that clearly the brain is trying to monitor this to say, careful, you know, I need to pay attention here, that these voices do exist in real life, and that listeners have gotten used to it. And currently we're exploring kind of like, you know, what happens in, with children who listen to these types of voices, and then how far can we help teachers perhaps use a slightly less harsh sounding voice to get same results. In our work, we can really focus on how these acoustic attributes may signal these specific social intentions and how they're perceived by these young listeners and how they shape their responses, right? I think, I mean, it's not just about how is it processed in the brain and do we pay attention to it, but really it's that what matters in the end is the outcome, right? Like, can I get someone to have a nicer learning environment and have a nicer learning experience, I guess, by providing the right kind of voice support to teachers and tell them, you know, if you were to speak in this type of voice without trying to be prescriptive, but just kind of saying, you know, these voice patterns elicit the following, you know, stay away from them and make learning more fun.
And I imagine there are a number of teachers, if they're listening now, thinking, yeah, after 8 hours of a day standing in front of young children screaming and yelling and not listening, that's where I'm going to be, is I'm going to be thinking about my supportive voice.
Well, so this is the really interesting bit about this, right? And we're working together with this company who provides voice training to teachers as part of teacher training in Essex. So there's a specific company that focuses on that. And their argument actually is that if we learned how to control our voice in an effective way, then this will help teachers at the end of the day, because they don't need to strain their voice as much. They don't need to raise their voice as much. If they know how to modulate their voice in specific situations, that will signal children right from the start, you know, this is what we're going to do now. And there is no discussion about this, and they don't need to yell, shout, or, you know, raise their voice. And so this is really the exciting bit, I think, for me, because this is for the first time something where I can feel our research has a direct applied implication, and it's exciting. And so if there are any teachers listening, we're trying to recruit right now to get voice samples, so, you know, please get in touch.
Excellent. Hopefully you'll get some emails. That's good. We both are lecturers as well as researchers at the University of Essex. And I just gave a 2-hour lecture last week to a social psych class, as I do, as they pay me to do. And part of that was about how within 50 milliseconds, we can visually determine if someone is extroverted. We can 50 milliseconds above chance determine if a photo of a man is likely to be gay or not, above accuracy, above chance. I mean, it's just audio, visual, our brains are just astoundingly quick at accurately processing important and meaningful social information.
Yeah, and it's funny that you mentioned those thin slice studies again, where people have focused predominantly on visual cues, for instance, whereas the same studies do exist with audio cues, and they show very, very similar results, right? So you can hear whether or not someone sounds more extroverted or more introverted, and people are quite accurate at detecting this from very, very short snippets of speech, or, you know, in this case, voice cues. So you just cut out bits and pieces of their running speech, play that to listeners, and they can tell you a whole lot about that person. So yeah, that is exciting.
Well, that gets me to the title of the podcast, which I stole from you, because I've seen you use it as a title of talks you've given, which is, it's not what you say, it's how you say it. What does that mean to you after all these years of working on this idea? What is the takeaway for you?
I don't know if I'm ready for a takeaway just yet, to be honest. I think
no lifetime achievement award.
No. I was going to say, I think in reality, what I've learned is that the voice conveys so much more about us than I was ready to believe 15 years ago. I think at that point when I started this journey and you know, came from the semantics, as I said, I focused on word meaning quite a bit and what that does to us if, you know, we have ambiguities. You know, those types of ambiguities are nothing compared to the ambiguous voice cues that we have to process each and every single day. So I think what that means to me in terms of, you know, it's not what you said, it's how you said it, really just means that there's so much in our voice and we need to learn to pay attention to these cues and to use them effectively. They have a huge effect on listeners. And I think that's what it currently means for me. Yeah.
It's interesting, right? Because, you know, evolutionarily, we were probably, I'm not an expert necessarily, but we were in small tribes, small groups who were like us and similar, and anything that was distant and different, that was probably a threat, or certainly we didn't even come across it. And yet at the same time, there's a part of me that says, but what it sounds like we're saying is like in a world now, in this modern world, where there's just, there's so much more heterogeneity of people and cultures and languages and abilities to communicate with each other with vast vocabularies. No, that's going to mean less. It will mean more for me that I can just pick up quickly. Like this person maybe doesn't have all the words that they need, but I just know they're in distress. If that chain of thought makes any sense, then it's like our evolutionarily sort of built-in system is actually still going to be beneficial for us in a world where we aren't necessarily going to have to rely as much on content and the semantics. It's just the tone. It's not what you said, it's how you said it.
No, I agree. I'm kind of thinking about it, but all of our studies would suggest the same thing, right? I mean, we can recognize how other people feel irrespective of language. So we've looked at Chinese speakers listening to English pseudo speech and vice versa. So we filtered out content. We looked at Hindu speakers. We looked at German, Spanish, French, all of those languages, and we played them the unknown language, and it was always the case that they could hear how someone felt, and there's no reason to believe that any of that needs to be linked to the words. And so perhaps, you know, in this current world, it'll be really important for us to pause at some point and just kind of pay attention to how someone is saying something to ensure that we do the right thing.
It seems like maybe what all your work is suggesting to me is that it is in us to actually be social and helpful and communicative with and among people who aren't necessarily like us. In those higher order, we created these cultures and these walls and these barriers, and we pay too much attention to them. They're different than me. I don't know what language you speak. But it doesn't mean anything. You'll know what I'm trying to say. Yes. You just got to stop for a moment and actually attend.
Yeah. And sometimes you don't even need to attend. And that's the really amazing bit for me, I think, to know that you could do the dishes and yet overhear a conversation outside on the street without knowing what that couple is talking about. Because let's say they speak Polish and yet I notice that she's in distress. He's trying to make up. You know, there are so many voice cues that people are using and that we are trained to process and pick up on.
Last bit, where are you going now? What is anything on your radar moving forward that changes direction or at all? Or is it more just trying to dig into the nuance and the complexity that we've been talking about?
I think I'm going to focus on two things. So one is looking at the way that we communicate through our voice in more subtle ways, right? Like I think motivations, that was a big part. Emotions, that's a big part. But again, there are so many other social intentions that we can communicate that don't necessarily fit that typical category. So you can, you know, there might be criticism in your voice that you may not be aware of when you talk to someone and therefore inadvertently you hurt them. Or there could be positive praise? And again, you know, what does that sound like? And how can I communicate this? Or, you know, do I have to be careful because I'm sending mixed signals? Those kind of things. So my plan is to focus quite a bit on these nuances, predominantly in the workplace, because that's something that over the years, people have come to me and have said, you know what, I can't say what it was. I just left this meeting feeling really uncomfortable. And I want to say it was the way that they talked and it wasn't what they said, because I can't go to HR right now and say, you know, this didn't work or that didn't work or they said that. It was just something in them. And I'm thinking about looking a lot into these types of voice patterns that can elicit those types of feelings and how we can make them better. And then on the other hand, as I said, I kind of want to explore in more detail the applied angle of my work. And the current focus is really on looking at the way that teachers use their voice in the classroom to create effective learning environments. But you can see that the same might be true for therapists or all sorts of other kind of professions where you need to talk to people and where it'll be crucial for them to know beneficial voice patterns that can just enhance their work.
The example you gave, I mean, I'm not an HR person or, you know, experienced in it, but I imagine that a lot of HR protocol and process is based on what was said, what was the content. Right. And it really would be incredibly powerful to be able to get a whole like industry, a whole, you know, HR sort of expertise to be aware that, you know what, sometimes someone, you know, we may have discounted years ago and someone said it was the way that they said it and been like, well, we have the transcript and there's nothing in here that's wrong or worrisome. And for you to be able to have over time, say, get to an HR person and have them go, oh, yeah, no, I'm going to pay attention to how it was said because that will matter.
No, I think that'd be great, right? If we could get to that situation of saying it mattered how they said it, and it did make a huge difference.
I can imagine how many people through the years have said it was the way it was said and just been discounted.
Yes, and there are very few studies. I mean, it's starting to emerge right now. I've looked at it a little bit. But a lot of times, as you said, it's anecdotal evidence, and they don't have any scientific evidence to show that, yes, those types of voice patterns can elicit feelings of a failure, of you know, lack of competency or those kind of things that you can communicate through voice. And you can suggest to someone, really, you know, you didn't do a great job without ever having to say you didn't do a great job. And so I'm hoping that this is going to be a fruitful endeavor. We'll see.
Well, Silke, thanks for coming on today. I hope you enjoyed sharing your work with us.
No, thank you very much for having me, Philip.
And thank you once again for checking out the Understanding Our Place in the World podcast. This podcast was produced by the Department of Psychology at the University of Essex. Make sure to check us out again, as we'll have another interview for you to enjoy in the coming weeks.